Out on Blu-ray now is The Devil's Reign from Severn Films, starring Ernest Borgnine, William Shatner, Ida Lupino, John Travolta, and High Priest of the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey. This release is loaded, a special edition loaded with tons of features, including interviews, commentary, trailers, and more. It's from a new 2K scan and comes in a limited slipcase available only at www.severn-films.com. Heaven help us all when the devil's reign comes.
Hail Satan!
It's face-melting good.
And also coming soon on December 5th is the Amicus Collection, which features the anthology Asylum, and Now the Screaming Starts, and The Beast Must Die, and the most terrifying movie ever made, Threads. So follow Severn Films on Facebook and look for that release on December 5th.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is movie buff owned and operated. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head on over to Diabolik DVD. They are constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. Lots of hard-to-find titles from Scorpion and Brulees from Code Red. Imports from all over the world, including titles from Camera Obscura, CMV, and more. They revamped their website earlier this year, and ordering has never been easier. And that's the only source you should order Code Red DVDs from for safety and guarantee.
This episode is also brought to you by Shudder, brought to you by AMC Networks. Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thriller, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals, and there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore.
New this week is Spookers. A close-knit New Zealand family runs Spookers, the largest and most successful haunted house in the Southern Hemisphere. The director deftly captures what's thrilling and enticing about haunted houses for the attendee, but more importantly, for the owners and employees, covering from all angles, from staff to the implications of using an abandoned asylum. Spookers is an encapsulation of why we love the genre and Halloween, as well as a touching look at those who feel freedom and family because of it. Streaming now exclusively on Shudder.
Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership, but our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
Okay, welcome to episode number 72 of Shockwaves. I'm your host, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Mr. L. Rakane.
Where have you been all my life?
Well, I've been here, God, I've been in a lot of your life.
Oh, that's true. Last Good 5 years of it.
Yeah, it's been pretty crazy. Also, your better half, really,
that's
I think,
right.
is Rebecca McKendry on
I
the other side of the table.
I am a streetwalking cheetah with our heart full of napalm.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, there you go.
I was listening to Iggy Pop on the way here. Okay. It's going to happen.
Last but not least, Mr. Ryan Turek.
The wart on your ass.
Hey, whoa.
That is
Whoa,
my
what are these two drinking?
Current mood.
Okay.
Yeah, this is our
current mood, wart on your ass.
This is our post Halloween blues kind of vibes, I guess. Yeah, sorry that we missed out, but we were just so pooped from Halloween, as I'm sure all of you were. And we could not actually find the strength or the will within us to make it here.
Yes, yes. It was October was an intense month. And so as soon as it ended, we were all just kind of like, we're done. But we're back. We have risen and ready to go again.
Basically, we're like, stay the fuck away from me, you three, for just a little while.
I love you guys, but give me a couple of days.
I have that text from Rob, and it'll be appearing on Deadline.com because I've reported it to my lawyer.
Yes. Oh. All right. No, all is well here in Shockwaves land. All right, so what should we kick off with? We've got stuff that we've seen.
Well, we have no guest today, which is the four of us.
Topic, baby.
So we've got a topic in store for you, but we should dive in because I'm sure there's a lot you guys
watched. I watched some weird stuff, guys.
Yeah, I did too.
What'd you guys well, let's go back to Halloween night or after Halloween. What did you watch anything to cap off the event?
Well, I mean, I deliriously finished my my anthology kick, which I will never do again.
Yeah, I don't know how you did that. That's like mind numbing, and just, I can never watch a movie a day. Like I've tried, and I can never do it.
Everybody's doing
like,
anthologies too.
Yeah, right. No, all the props in the world to Brian Collins who did Horror Movie a Day, because I remember he did an episode of Killer POV pretty early on, explaining his whole process and how he has to start before midnight to make a count.
Yeah.
From that day, so I did the same thing. Halloween Day, I woke up early that morning and I watched Tales of Halloween was my Halloween movie, mm-hmm. Ironically enough, which I watched in the Epic Offices, which is the company that made it, because Halloween night, myself and pretty much every human being I know in Los Angeles went to see John Carpenter, mm-hmm. Except for you three. But you've all seen him.
Three times last time.
I've seen him before, but yeah, when you have kids, that's like you have to do that.
It was and it was great. I mean, look, if you haven't seen John, you have to see him on this tour as soon as possible. The merch that he has now is, I mean, he is he likes to make money, so you can bet your ass there is plenty of merchandise. There's brand new shirts for everything. The Escape from New York one is actually pretty rad.
I saw lots of photos of him with people. Was he doing photo ops or how was it?
Yeah, I mean, he does a VIP package where you can pay a little extra to go, like, I guess it's like an hour early and meet him, do like a meet and greet beforehand and then take photos or whatever. But the show is great. And I mean, look, there's something special about hearing him play the Halloween theme on Halloween night. It is pretty darn cool. It was pretty much the same set that that we're already used to. But he did add a few, because Anthology came out, he added a couple tracks, such as, what did he do? He did the Village of the Damned track, mm-hmm. Body Bags, which is a fun surprise.
Vampires,
Starman. Yep. So he kind of...
Starman's a great track.
It is. So
epic and sweeping and beautiful.
He swapped out some of the Lost themes for those tracks.
Yeah.
Although, look, I would see him watch... I'd watch him play both Lost themes albums in a row, and I'd be totally content with it. But that was my Halloween night plan. And then after that, I have stuff that I want to talk about from that tail end, but I've just pretty much been watching, like, TV and like Marvel movies. I'm just I need a break from horror. So,
well, on that note, should we talk about Stranger Things 2? Have you guys seen the entire season?
I am only on the sixth episode.
All right, let's catch up.
I just did the punk episode last night. Sorry, guys.
Oh, that's as far as you got? Seven?
All right,
seven.
When you guys finish, let's then all discuss.
Which I would call the seed of Chucky of the episode.
We don't, without non spoiler initial thoughts?
Sure, sure. I mean, like, I think it's I'm not going to spoil a thing. Here's the thing. I watched the first six episodes and then I got sidetracked by work and life stuff, so I had to take a break. But
did you marathon it? Because I remember season one, you had a
marathoned
party.
It, but there was just it dropped on Halloween weekend. How do you marathon on Halloween weekend? And so when we settled in to watch episode seven, we were like, oh, we got seven, eight, and nine. Do we just watch the one episode? No, we were up till 2 a.m. watching the entire
thing. Finishing it up.
And the show is just, I mean, like, it hits every pleasure center that I love. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the weak spot, which we could discuss later on, I still enjoy it.
And I'll argue, I don't think that's a weak spot if it's what I think it is. But.
Yeah. But listen, I mean, I think it is, it's definitely a sequel. It feels like a sequel. Yeah. There, it doesn't have a lot of what I feel like are kind of revelations or big ideas, and a certain sense of immediacy as the first season did. Mm-hmm. But then again, it's the second season, and you already know these characters, and you got to play a lot of catch up in the wake of what happened in Hawkins, you know, in that first season. So because the characters are so great, I didn't mind just being there for their kind of lesser moments, lesser dramatic moments, you know, of them just going to school and talking about the new girl and all that stuff. I think that was all great. So when the plot actually kicks in, I'm eager and I'm hungry for it. But I think it's still strong. It wasn't as good as season one, but I love it.
Mm. See, I loved it. And I might have liked it a little bit. I don't know. I just...
Don't get
maybe
me wrong, it's
more...
like, it's an A for me, but it's just, you know.
Well, to me, it's like when the first season started, there was no real hype around it. Nobody knew what the hell it was. Mm-hmm. And so I remember seeing the first episode of season one and thinking, like, it just immediately hit all my sweet spots mm-hmm. that I was like, ooh, this is special. I'm going to watch one a day. I'm not going to marathon this. I want to savor this. And so that's what I did with season one. And as soon as season two dropped, I did the exact same thing. Like, I watched the first episode of season two and I was like, it's just as good. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is exact. Like, it was just so, it's very rare where it's just such a perfect marriage of actor and characters that it's like, I want to spend time with these characters. Yeah. They're that good. So I get what you mean. Like, no matter what, you could take all the horror elements out. Yeah. I will see a teen drama with all those characters if it has nothing to do with horror at all. Yeah. And so I absolutely loved it. And I spent literally 9 days just watching it consecutively. And it's a little weird how something becomes a cultural phenomenon and then everybody just feels inclined to shit on it immediately or whatever the case is. But I don't care. It just makes me happy. Like, literally just makes me happy. So we'll get into more details when you guys finish it up.
Yeah.
But I loved it. I would recommend, if I don't know if you've seen him, but Netflix also did a after show called Beyond Stranger Things. And they're short. They're like 20 minutes long each.
Good?
They're excellent. They're great. And obviously they're not like per episode. Yeah. Like, the first one spoils the whole show, so you have to watch them after you watch the show.
Yeah.
But I think it's great because you really get an idea of how they broke the season. Like, it goes into detail because there's little things like characters. There's two characters in particular that kind of team up. I know you posted a photo of them.
I love it. Yeah.
And the way they talk about how that happened organically in the writing room is basically they both ended up with like nothing to do.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, wait, what if we put them both together? And it's just like, how did we not think of that from the get-go?
Yeah. Did you guys see the babysitter poster that they
That's what I meant.
Yeah, no, I figured that's what you're talking about, but I don't want to spoil it.
Well, the funny thing is a little behind us, peek behind the curtain. So we were going to cast him, the older brother, in one of our films.
Oh.
But it was contingent on Stranger Things 2. Stranger Things 2 got greenlit. And we were like, oh shit, man, we're not gonna be able to get him. And then it looked like there was a ray of hope, and we were like, oh good, we might. But then there was like this big revelation that had occurred, and he had discovered just how much he was gonna be used. And we were like, fuck, we lost him. That's it. And so I was like, let me just see how much they're gonna use him. And I saw the trailer, and I was like, oh, he's just playing a number two guy again. And it's like, no. He graduated.
Yeah.
They graduated him. So that was great.
The only complaint I have about it, which isn't a complaint, it's more how much you like saying, is this season moves real fast. Mm-hmm. And so it's like slipping through your fingers like something.
Everybody says it's
like,
slow.
Really?
All the criticism I've seen, it's like it moves too slow.
There's so much happening already.
Yeah, I feel like it's jumping around a lot more. Like, we've got different factions. Like, but I'm enjoying all of the different plot lines, so it's not a complaint. Like, I've really enjoyed the stuff that they've done with Dart. I'm still only on – I just did the punk rock episode.
Oh, yeah. No, that's what I just did.
Yeah.
The
Mohawk dude.
Wasn't my favorite point in the movie, in the show so far.
Not
but, you know.
Mine either, but I didn't
I'll argue it later.
Okay. I would rather watch that than something else. It was not – my favorite.
I'll just say this
factions.
About that episode, X-Men After School Special.
Yeah.
Totally felt totally
that's
fine.
That's exactly
whatever.
What it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But that said, I've still been absolutely enjoying it and really, loving it. And I love the inclusion of the Max character as well.
Well, we should do a spoiler episode later on.
Yeah.
Once you guys have finished,
I'll do a whole.
That sounds good. Cool. All right. What else? What did you guys do for Halloween? Or are you going to jump into what you've seen?
Yeah, a little both.
It ties into what I said.
Go for it.
I watched 13 Ghosts on Halloween.
Old or
the
new?
Remake?
No, the Joel Silver produced Dark Castle remake of 13 Ghosts. Yeah. Oh, no, I thought you said the original.
My co-teacher
Matthew
did
Lillard?
The effects on that.
Oh, God.
Did all the digital stuff.
That movie is a fucking mess.
Oh, is it?
No, listen. I really, I really love what Dark Castle attempted to do. And I think more or less they succeeded. House on Haunted Hill is a great remake. It's really fun. I like Ghost Ship.
That is a great opening, and it's
a maritime ghost story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, come on. 13 Ghosts has so much ambition and so much fun, but it is all over the place.
Oh,
I mean, there
gosh.
Is just so much scatterbrained scripting and storytelling. But it's still fun because you've got these fucking 13 ghosts just wandering
That's
around
what I think
the glass
it's fun.
Ceiling.
It's like, oh look, the juggernaut's in your kitchen. And
the funny thing is,
I
laughed because they walk down the hall and it's just a boy with an arrow in his head, and they're like, oh no, wait, don't get close to him, and the kid's just standing there. But because of the like scattered ADD style editing, it was like they try to make him really scary, and it's like, okay, this is a good attempt. But I really like Matthew Lillard in it. I like. F. Murray Abraham is fucking selling it.
Yeah.
Selling the movie. Like, all the deep mythology, way too much mythology, but he's really going for it. But the production design's beautiful. The K&B makeup effects are great. It's just a really dumb movie. Just really dark.
Oh, I've always liked that one. Not as much as House on Haunted Hill, but I definitely saw the two of them back to back and was like, this is why I love horror. And I still feel that way about 13 Ghosts.
I remember during the junket for 13 Ghosts, they gave us a, they always give you swag. And in the swag bag came a shower CD player. So you can just hang it up in your shower, and it just says 13 Ghosts.
That makes no sense to have a CD player.
It makes no sense shower, whatsoever.
Yeah. For House on Haunted Hill, since we're talking about that one, I still have what I got at the junket for House on Haunted Hill, which is this little coffin-shaped pencil box. And it still sits on my desk, awesome. And it's a House on Haunted Hill pencil case. So.
It's a shame like they didn't get Malone to do all of them. That could have been cool. Yeah. Like, it could have been Malone's world.
Yeah, yeah.
But then there's that fear.com.
Perversion.
Anyway, that's all I remember. That's all I remember from that movie. Speaking of dumb, I saw The Babysitter. I will say it's very slick. Like you guys both said, it definitely has a lot of things that win you over about it. Like I think the boy in it is phenomenal. Like, I love that guy's performance. I think the babysitter, she does a great job too, but the kid is great. But it's just something about that movie that you're like, it really made me miss House of the Devil. Like, in the sense that it's just so kind of stupid. Like, why are they there? And what are they doing? And who are these stupid characters with her? So, I couldn't kind of get over that. But it is well made. So, if you wanted a quick, 80-minute fun Netflix movie, my problem is it's not really hard. It's got those horror elements, but so light that it's just really a comedy. So, I don't know. I didn't love it. I actually watched Trick or Treat for the first time since seeing it originally Halloween night.
Yeah.
So I know most people use that as their go-to, and you should, because it's freaking great. Like, it was really cool to watch that on Halloween. And I can't think of a movie that would get me more in the spirit than that now after rewatching. But I did want to say, we never really, and I know Becca finished it, we never kind of wrapped on Channel Zero, which I finished that day. And, I really like it, but compared to the first one, it's stylistically perfect. But man, it's got this like one tone
the whole
start
time.
To end.
That was my biggest complaint, and I'm glad that you finished it, because I hadn't gotten to talk about it with anybody. And I think I actually talked to you guys behind the scenes about that, about how the first two episodes, I was like, this is amazing.
Because it has a great emotional hook, the first episode. Yeah. It has a great hook.
And then it didn't go anywhere.
It's
and
really
by
unusual.
The end, it was like it was going in a cycle, like where it's like they're in the world, they're out, but then they have to go back in, but then they come back. Oh, but we got to go back in now. And I was just like,
it's like, it's very much in the vein of It Follows in terms of an aesthetic, like it even looks like it's in the same world, but unlike It Follows has high and low points like that really kind of rattle you. This doesn't really, and it's interesting, but as an art thing, as a horror art thing, I really recommend it. It's like incredible, like the in terms of how it's put together, but man, by the end of it, I just felt like, oh, that's it. Like, whereas season one really had a through line that I think, even though the last episode of season one wasn't my favorite of it, I really, it justified where it went with that character.
And season one also had like a mystery that you were trying to unravel what's going on. This one, you kind of realize by midway,
it's all cerebral. It's like all cerebral or something. Yeah.
Can you stream it on sci-fi.com?
I had it all DVR'd, so it's hard to know.
That's what you did. Yeah. They did that with the first season, where you could stream it on the website. I have it all DVR'd, too.
Hear
I'm behind.
Somebody rattling around your living room, it'll be me.
that shouldn't take away from the show, because I think they're still taking these bold risks, and I love it. I really think the show itself is awesome.
Yeah,
like,
it's
I'm
still
really
unlike
a fan.
Anything else you've ever seen. Like, there's nothing I could compare it to. I mean, it's got like an It Follows aesthetic, but that's it.
Yeah, it's very surreal and art. It feels like it's art, like they're actually creating art pieces inside it, and it's really unique, but
cool.
But yeah, anyway, so that's Channel Zero.
Nice. So since we're on TV for a little bit, so the week of Halloween, I bought a Roku, which I had no idea what the hell a Roku was, but Dave and I were suddenly like, we can't watch news, because we cut the cord a while ago and we just had Hulu and Netflix, and then suddenly we were like, we want to see, what crazy political shit's happened today, because it's something every day. So we wanted...
Go to Twitter.
I know, right? but we were like, we would like to be able to watch. And I missed KTLA always did the 5 o'clock car chase. I kind of missed that.
5 o'clock car
It's true. Every day at 5 o'clock, there's a car chase on the 101 or the 405 or the 5. There's one somewhere in LA. So we decided to go get a Roku so that we could watch local news at least. And so I've been playing around with that. Coolest thing by far that I discovered on the Roku is Night Flight has its own channel on Roku. Now, any of you guys familiar with Night Flight?
Becca, you come to the table with VOD services and channels. I know I don't know.
How
so
the fuck do you not know Night Flight?
I have no idea. What is this Fandor. New? What
okay,
is this,
look. Other people in the room
addiction?
Know Night Flight. Greg knows Night Flight. Okay.
There's no one in this room.
Doesn't count.
What was the previous
I
thing?
I don't have a mic. It
I'm
count.
Telling you guys, some of our listeners are going to give you guys shit for not knowing
right,
what
so
Night, Flight
Night Flight
is. So Night Flight was this TV show that was on in the 80s. And it was literally
I thought you were saying it was a channel.
Oh, no, no, no. Night Flight was this TV show. And it was very much like USA Up All Night, but it was a lot more random and a lot more weird. It wasn't just like, you know, Rhonda Shear being like, okay, now we're gonna watch, you know, Friday Three. It was very much like, okay, we're gonna watch an interview with the Talking Heads, and now we're gonna watch this weird student film, and here is this crazy exploitation film you've never seen, and now we're gonna close it out with this like atomic stock footage. And so it was always like this weird ass stuff. And it's where I saw a lot of, I'll say, more art artistic stuff. Like, it's where I saw a lot of like weird art films. It's where I think I first saw Sun Ra, and you know, just like weird stuff. It's where I got introduced to a lot of punk bands as well. I remember that they did this big thing with the Bad Brains, and it's where I first kind of got introduced and started
I
loving
love the
them.
Logo.
Yeah, it's
all right. We believe you.
Okay, shut the fuck up, Kane. Anyway, it's awesome. Night Flight rules. They have their own channel on Roku.
That's cool.
And I had talked about previously on the show before about how one of my old favorite VOD channels from when I lived in New York was that we used to get Something Weird on VOD, and all of the Something Weird, like the majority of their titles, were available on their VOD channel. It's part of Night Flight now. So the Night Flight Roku channel, you get all of these Something Weird titles, and all of Arrow Video's titles are on there as well. So it's like one giant package. So I've been like all over this, watching just all types of crazy stuff.
That's
so
cool.
Highly recommend, if you have the Roku, check out the Night Flight.
So I pulled up a Night Flight guide from the 80s. Night Flight, the number one favorite cable show. April 15th, Millie Jackson interview. The Making of Gandhi. Ian Hunter in concert, Adam Ant interview, Space Patrol. So this is very
all over,
very,
the, place.
All over the
place. It's all over the
place.
It's completely. But I mean, like, this is, I saw so much crazy stuff on here. They did a lot of metal. I remember seeing Decline of Western Civilization, both one and two, on here for the first time. I used to watch, they did wrestling stuff. So like Aztec women versus, or the wrestling women versus the Aztec mummy or whatever it was. They used to show those, the Mil Mascara films.
Somebody's
so.
Nodding somebody their head
gets,
in this room.
Somebody gets all of this stuff. So this was where I got introduced to a lot of like weird cinema that I ended up loving. So check out Night Flight on Roku. So yeah, I'll let that rest for a while, guys. Somebody else go.
Rob?
Good God. Okay, let's see. So I also did, right on the cusp of Halloween, I did a triple bill at the New Beverly. Three old movies. They were showing The Old Dark House from 1963.
Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh, that's a fun
one. Yeah, with The Cat and the Canary from 1939, and then finally Scared Stiff from 1952. I'd never seen any of these movies, and I was like, screw it, that sounds like... And they were all fairly predominantly short. So yeah. I was like, oh, that, I could probably survive that. So The Old Dark House is interesting because I had confused this with the original with Boris Karloff. I didn't know there were two.
I didn't realize there were. I saw the Boris Karloff. Remember, I reviewed it a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, yeah. No, so this one was directed by William Castle in 1963.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And is a very comedic kind of – it was really, really fun. What was great, though, is just as it was about to start, you know, usually somebody from the New Bev introduces the films, and they're like, hey, so you're about to see a film print that was struck – specifically for tonight, like it's a brand new print of The Old Dark House. So don't be alarmed. The movie was released in the US in black and white, but it was released theatrically in color in Europe. And so you're about to see the color version.
Whoa.
And so I was like, we were like, whoa, like a brand new color print. Looked amazing. Really a lot of fun. Basically, it's kind of, it reminded me a lot of Clue. It's like a murder mystery where this guy's got a really odd roommate who begs him to come to his house. He's like, you need to come to my house and meet my family.
Wait, which title is this?
The Old Dark House.
Okay.
This is the William Castle one. And so he's kind of this eccentric car salesman that goes to visit this old dark house, and he kind of gets trapped there because there's a big storm and his car breaks down. And basically somebody in the family appears to be wanting to kill off everyone else in the family over a fortune, and they think he's like kind of in on it. But it's like his comedic timing is really great and all the characters are great. I have a little bit of a blind spot when it comes to William Castle. Like, I've seen some of his films, but this one, of all the ones I've seen so far, this was just the most fun. Mm-hmm. It was just pure fun from start to finish. And it was great to see it on the big screen. And I can't imagine in black and white. That's the other thing. It just seems like a very vibrant color movie. Yeah.
So there's nothing connecting this old Dark House to the old one?
Yeah, that's
conceptually.
They're both based on the same book.
Yeah. Oh.
That's the funny thing.
Because the other one's not a whodunit. Interesting.
No.
It's much more of like a murder.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Like crazy brothers lighting stuff on fire.
But that's what's funny about it is they're both based loosely on the same novella, and it's like totally different interpretations of it. And then I stuck around for The Cat and the Canary, which stars Bob Hope. I'd never seen this movie either, and this was also very, very funny. Basically, it's a family that's coming to a remote house out on a little like lagoon or island to it's been 10 years since their relative died, and they're reading the will. And so, of course, the stipulation with the will is so-and-so, you know, they open one envelope and so-and-so gets the all the money, but if they go crazy within 24 hours, it goes to whoever's in envelope to. So obviously it's like one of those, you know, everybody in the family wants to question the sanity of the main person. And Bob Hope, another blind spot is I didn't realize he's very young in the movie and really funny. Mm-hmm. And what's funny, though, is like not all his delivery works, but it's the way he delivers it that's still like none of the jokes are good.
Yeah.
But his delivery is so spot on that I was like thoroughly entertained by this. So that was great, The Cat and the Canary. And then I didn't stay for Scared Stiff. I watched a little bit of it, which is it's a Lewis and Clark movie. So, it was fine. But I was just so tired at that point. And again, I had an anthology squeeze in. So that was my triple bill.
Get it in before midnight.
Creep 2? You've seen it?
That was a long time ago. I cannot speak to it.
Oh, well, I saw Creep 2.
Yeah.
You can talk about it.
I can speak it. I liked it. I liked it almost as much as the first one. The only difference is you liked it more. Yeah. No,
I think it's more. I like it more.
I'd say, let me put it this way. The middle of this movie is much better than the first. Like the middle section of this movie is excellent.
Yes.
Like when you basically have these two characters kind of going at it, the ending's just not as the first one has a great ending, like an ending that really kind of a cliffhanger ending. I feel like this kind of maybe whimpers a little, but the basic setup is there's a vlogger this woman who's, you know, she kind of tries to help people and reach out to people, and she's really trying to find connection in the world through her work, but she's kind of getting depressed because she realizes she doesn't get a lot of hits on her show. And so she is thinking about throwing in the towel, and then she reads Mark Duplass's character's post, the same kind of post he put out there to draw on the character in the first film. If you haven't seen it, I won't totally spoil it for you. Well, fuck it. He is a serial killer. I think that is key to know from the first movie. So in the second movie, she shows up to his house, and what's he say? He's saying, like, must enjoy interview with the vampire.
Yeah, I know.
That's a really important thing for him. He's like, I figure that would scare someone off if they weren't into it. And so she shows up, and
one of the early things that he makes her do, he's like, I'm just gonna take all my clothes off,
yeah
and I'm just gonna lay myself
he goes
bare.
Full bacon
he goes full bacon
right on
and then
camera.
He asks her to do it because it and it's not a sexual thing, it's just more of laying yourself
reveal yourself. He's basically full of shit. What's so cool about it is you got a character who's already a liar because he's a serial killer, but also he's just full of shit. He's like conceited, he's just like a bad joke of a serial killer who wants to be remembered in a very specific way, but he's not being truthful, and she's trying to get to the truth, and she's really great. She really like kind of steals this movie, even though Mark's great in it. She steals this movie because she's playing it just like against your expectation. She's never scared, she's never frightened off, she's like really in it for the whole long run. So it's at its best, it's like two characters just really connected, and that's when it's a really effective movie. Maybe slightly less effective as a horror movie by the end. It's more effective just as a character piece. But you know, I had fun watching it. I thought it was cool. Did you guys make that or no?
Patrick, we're involved to like a, you know, to a degree. It's a much higher up thing with Blum and Duplass.
Did you tell me off air to like it?
No.
Okay. Let's just be clear. That was just me.
I don't know why none of you motherfuckers told me to see Night School.
I did.
I've never seen it.
And my triple features on Pure Cinema. It was my Just Before Dawn. What's the middle one? Shit. Now I'm going to fuck it up. It ends with Night School.
Night School was a blind buy for me because Warner Brothers put it on a Blu-ray, and I watched it over the weekend, and oh my God.
Yeah, man.
Night School.
It's a giallo.
It is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
So if you guys don't know, Night School is set in Boston, and it's basically about a killer running around in full motorcycle gear, including a helmet, with a really badass Blade running around and chopping ladies' heads off. Mm-hmm. And at the center of it is a really bad detective who is trying to figure out why people are losing their heads. And it could be the local professor who studies
weird pagan cultures
and pagan rituals and stuff.
Shower
maybe.
Scenes, baby.
Shower scenes with shower scene. Raspberry sauce. Could it be him? Maybe. Could it be one of his assistants? Who knows? Could it be the pissed off dean? Maybe.
There's probably a janitor too out there, I'm sure.
There's a janitor.
There's always a janitor.
But the great thing is yes, you're right. It is very giallo-esque. It takes itself it plays itself pretty serious until director Ken Hughes starts playing with the tone in a really big way. Where the audience member is an active participant in the investigation because there's this great moment when the detective really, really early on starts to discover that the killer loves placing the body and the head very far apart. So the cops arrive on the scene. They're like, well, there's the body, but where's the head? And then they got to go look for the head. And it's a scavenger hunt.
Did they find it in food at one point?
Like, well, this is what I'm building to. So there's a moment in which the detective doesn't even get to this scene of the crime, but someone dies at a restaurant and one of the cooks shows up and he's like, God damn it, Alice. I'm just going to name the waitress Alice.
Yeah.
Damn it, Alice. You left the place in disarray. Where is Alice? And then these two construction workers come in because it's early morning. They're like, hey, where's our food? And he's like, I got stew. And he's like, great. So then the audience member is following the head chef as he's trying to discover where Alice is, but we all know he's gonna find a head. So he does. He's like, open the fridge. Oh, he's gonna find a head. Nope. Oh, he's gonna grab the pot. Nope. Where's the head? Could it be in a box of apples? So for 5 minutes straight, right. You're just sitting there going, oh, it's gonna be in here. Oh, it's gonna be in here. And you're like, there's certain joy in it. And it kind of conflicts with everything that's so serious about the movie.
Tone,
But it's so much fun.
And it's set in Boston, right?
Huh?
It's a Boston set movie.
Yeah. And it's the only guy who has like a really true Boston accent is the scumbag creeper that works with where is he? Oh, he works at the restaurant.
Yeah.
Really, really fun. Really fun. And the reveal is really great too. But I this was a great Sunday afternoon, man. I had such a blast with it. And Jeff over at Scream Factory.
Jeff Nelson?
He's like, this is the first time watching it. I'm like, yes.
I'm going to mention him in a moment too. I love excellent. This cover. This is a Warner Archive release, right?
Yeah. So it is.
I've never seen this, but I love the cover. He's got a report card. It says, A is for apple, B is for bed, C is for co-ed, D is for dead. F is for failing to keep your head.
I remember the VHS cover of this so much, and I still think I've ever seen it.
That's great.
It's a fun movie. Rachel Ward is in it. Rachel Ward. She's in the shower. Awesome. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Again, nice.
Gonna keep hitting the shower.
Becca?
Yeah. So let's see which one to do next. I'll go with the weird one. So I watched a horror film from India.
Understatement of the decade. Becca going for the weird
one. Is this the math one?
No. This, but I have heard of this one. So, but I watched. So I have a lot of students from all over the world, and one of my students from India was like, you've got to start checking out some India horror films. So I've been watching a whole bunch. Like, I watched one called Rat that was really cool. And the one that I watched most recently that I found really fascinating was this film called 13B. And it, I can't pronounce whatever the title is in Hindi. I wish I could, but, we'll go with 13B, which is what it was released, overseas as. And the whole concept of it, and you have to allow for some cultural differences here, two brothers and their wives and their children and the two brothers' mothers, all move into a flat together. Which is not the issue. That's just kind of like it's accepted. Extended family lives together. They all move into a flat together, and they're very upwardly mobile. You know, they've all got promotions. And during the day, the two brothers go off to work, and the mom and the two wives sit around and watch soap operas. And in addition to all of this weird stuff going on in the flat, like the lift keeps breaking, and for some reason they can't put nails in the walls. Like whenever they try to nail something into the wall, something horrible happens. The women start watching this soap opera that seems to be exactly mirroring their lives. And then one of the brothers gets really suspicious of it and starts really investigating the soap opera and where it's being filmed. And it gets really creepy how detailed it is and how exactly it's mirroring. And, you know, when bad things happen, they happen to them in real life. But so it's like you watch an episode and then the next day something almost identical happens.
Like
you.
A Channel Zero.
Yeah. Kind of and so it's really, it's really trippy the way that it works out. And the movie, it definitely kind of flows a bit differently than we would see in American movies, where it's a bit slower. It's like 2 hours long. Things are paced a little bit differently. The revelations aren't quite as huge. It's not like I can't put things in the wall and the nail is now through my hands. It's just like they establish that you can't nail things into the wall and then they move on. And so it goes to really cool places. I don't want to blow the ending because it definitely has kind of a nice little twist to it. But yeah, I was really surprised by it. Something to prepare people before they see it. And this is very common in Indian horror films, I've learned, is that you have to have some music. Think Bollywood here, people. So there's like a scene where these two characters are about to have sex and then it goes into them singing a song on a beach.
Nice.
Instead of sex. So this just exists and you just kind of have to separate this and realize that that's a cultural difference and don't let that taint the rest of the horror film. It happens a couple of times where characters will break into song, but just keep going with it.
Interesting.
And yeah, it was a really fascinating film.
Well, and I say interesting because, I mean, I had seen my fair share of Indian horror films, but none broke out into song, but they do exist.
Yes. So this one definitely had a couple of song numbers in it. And and it was very kind of almost 80s montage-y where like two characters were sitting on a bed looking at a Kama Sutra book and they're like, oh, you want to try this? You want to try this? And then they kiss and then like this song fades in and suddenly they're on a beach in like sexy clothing singing to each other instead of the sex scene. And it was just like, Dave and I look at each other, we laugh, and then we keep going with this. So yeah, but it was a really fascinating movie and I'm really kind of enjoying exploring this other area of horror that I'd never really ventured into before. So I'm looking for other Indian horror films.
Well, wait till you see ours, Becca.
I am excited. I know Blumhouse has been kind
trailer comes out
drifting
soon.
Into this area as well. So yeah.
And people can find that on Fandor?
No. This one, thanks, Kane. Thanks there. No, you actually have to do some hunting for this. The DVD's a little hard to track down. Just a little. And I think you have to have a region free.
You basically need a Becca in your life to watch this movie. You have to rent Becca.
I'll come. I'll show you the movie. It's awesome. So 13B.
13B.
Ryan mentioned our good friend Jeff Nelson from Scream Factory earlier today. And bless him, because I would not discover some of these oddities if not for him buying from other companies. And so he alerted me that there's a company called Doppelganger releasing. They've been in the news in the past couple of days because they are partnering up to release the opera and the sect and all. They're going to help with distribution.
Oh, and they're related to the Music Box,
Scorpion,
right?
Yeah,
that's right.
And so they put out a Blu-ray of Wes Craven's Summer of Fear.
Linda Blair?
Which is his TV movie with Linda Blair.
Written by Lois Duncan, or based off a Lois Duncan book.
Yes, based on a Lois Duncan book.
Cool. Yeah, because I've read the book.
And I mean, as soon as I saw him, I was like, "What? Wait, somebody put a Blu-ray of that out?" And he's like, "Yep." So it was like $15. I ordered it on Amazon. Got it. I'd never seen this Wes Craven movie. It's pretty interesting. I mean, basically anything with Linda Blair from this period, you know, when she was kind of an awkward teen is a little odd, but yeah, it's pretty funny. I mean, basically she's a teenage girl that loves horses and lives with her, you know, her family and has this great boyfriend. And it turns out in the opening that, her cousin's parents have a horrible car accident. And so they die, and now they're bringing this cousin home to live with them. And as soon as she does, it basically it turns into one of those kind of like it. Well, I mean, it's a TV movie, so it feels like After School Special, where basically she hates her cousin because her cousin is ruining everything in her life. Like she's supposed to like take part in this like horse racing thing, and she wakes up with like welts all over her face. Like she gets really sick. The cousin steals her boyfriend out of nowhere. Her best friend is a young Fran Drescher. Nice. What's his name? Jeff East, who is the young Clark Kent from Superman the movie, is her older brother. And that's there's this weird, this is around the same year too. There's this weird thing where like everyone's kind of in love with the cousin, including her brother and father. So
weird.
Like it really borders on like inappropriate, and she may be a witch. So,
okay.
So it's fun and fine. It's just kind of like over the top drama, and then the last 20 minutes is pretty like bonkers and insane.
Do you see shades of early like Wes thematically?
Kind of. It's definitely early.
Yeah.
So it's like
just figuring it out.
Like I noticed, I thought it was interesting that they were like long takes of like two people in frame talking, and it's kind of like. He's not quite there yet. This is the guy that didn't watch movies until he was 30 years old that just started making movies. But it is fascinating just to see it. And again, it's like that combination of Wes Craven and Linda Blair and then seeing people like, you know, Jeff Easton and Fran Drescher. Right, like, right. It's just one of those weird oddities. And the fact that it exists on Blu-ray is just a magical thing. And as one of the special features is a brand new interview with Linda Blair about it. So
I can't wait.
It's pretty cool. Definitely recommend it.
I did not realize that X-Ray was the same movie as Hospital Massacre.
Oh, and by the way, Summer Fear was also called... That is true.
Little spot of trivia for you kids. I did not realize that. What were you going to say, Ron?
This one is also called... Summer Fear is how it's released, but it's also called Stranger in Our House. Yeah. That's the alternate title. So... X-Ray? Was that
anyway,
what you
were talking
about?
Anyway, yeah, X-Ray is Hospital Massacre. That's my big reveal.
That feels like a very old man Kane thing.
Yeah. You're like, what? It's the same movie?
It's the same.
Oh, no, for years I wanted to see Hospital Massacre, but I didn't realize it's the same movie. I hadn't seen X-Ray. I got even more excited when I realized Valentine's Day film. So I got super excited going, oh my God, there's this great slasher. And then it's not a good movie.
That's awesome.
I thought it was incredibly boring.
What?
Once she gets in the like the opening scene's awesome.
You're out of your mind.
And then when she's in the hospital, like who goes to the hospital, takes off all their clothes, sits there in front of the doctor, and then nothing happens.
People
like,
in a horror
around.
Film.
I know, but I just found once they got there, I was disappointed. I was so excited. Thought I had discovered something special.
Aww.
Just wasn't.
Wow.
This is my heartbreaking post Halloween moment.
It's got two titles.
X-Ray.
I'm not having two titles.
They never even got her X-ray results.
Well,
so is that a review?
Yeah. I guess. Who's the actress?
Are you done, Kane? Are you done?
Barbie Benton.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
She's done a lot.
That's the best part of it.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, hey guys, on Halloween night, I watched Angel Heart because I decided. Okay. Yeah,
that's a good movie.
No, I hadn't seen it in probably 15 years or so. I mean, it was definitely like maybe the 90s since I watched it, and forgot how just absolutely wonderful it is. So I was really excited to see it again. If you have not watched Angel Heart in a long time, I recommend revisiting it. The performances, I forgot how amazing it was. There were layers that I never saw before. Like I remembered that, you know, Robert De Niro spent the whole time eating eggs, but like the legal firm is McIntosh and Winesap, named after apples because the apples, it's temptation. And yeah, there was just like all of these different layers that I never picked up on before. I never realized how much Johnny Favorite's song is repeated. Like he even whistles it throughout the whole thing. And just all of these different layers that I never noticed before. So yeah, it was just really cool. And then I, once I started doing some research, I discovered that Alan Parker, the guy who directed it, specialized in musicals. Like he did Fame and Bugsy Malone. He did Pink Floyd's The Wall and Evita and just a whole bunch of other musicals. And then when you watch it with that in mind, you realize kind of how choreographed a lot of his scenes are and how everything kind of flows in that same kind of manner. So yeah,
he's a very good director in general.
Yeah,
a lot of his movies are good.
And then I realized that the role of Harry Angel was actually supposed to be Nicholson. And then I was trying to picture the movie with Jack Nicholson in it instead of name just escaped me.
Mickey Rourke.
Thank
Mickey
you.
Rourke.
Like
he
what
been a lot
been
older
like.
Than Rourke.
Yeah.
He's like 20 years older, I think.
Apparently, he was like one of their first choices. Yeah. And then,
I thought you meant in the De Niro role, which makes sense because he's that in The Departed pretty much.
No, from what I read, it was supposed to be him in the Mickey Rourke role. Weird. So, yeah.
Either way, yeah, that's a great movie. I haven't seen that since probably came to Blu-ray. Is it on Blu-ray?
I don't know. I watched it on VOD. Yeah. I rented it. But yeah, definitely worth revisiting. Still such a tight film.
All right. Anything else? Nice.
Yeah, I want to add a little oddball to the mix. Mm-hmm. So when you, and I'm not dropping names just because I've been working a lot with them lately, but when you're in a car with David Gordon Green and Danny McBride,
dropping
movies,
names.
Movies like Bad Ronald come up.
Oh, jeez.
I love Bad Ronald.
From 1974. And I was like, what the fuck is Bad Ronald?
Have you not seen Bad Ronald?
Never seen Bad Ronald? Oh, my God.
Bought it on the spot, guys. Watched it yesterday.
I'm sure you recognize how many movies have ripped it off now, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And there was like a little producerial part of my brain. It was like, could we do this? But it's, listen, the thing is, it's not as batshit crazy as you want it to be, but the setup is pretty bonkers. And if you guys don't know, basically Kim Hunter plays the mother of Bad Ronald. And Bad Ronald is just an oddball kid in high school. And while out going to ask a girl out on a date, she turns him down and he cuts through the woods and then he scares some little girl on a bike. And then the little girl on a bike gets into an altercation with him and he accidentally pushes her and she falls onto a rock and she hits her head and she dies. So he comes home and he's like, "Mom, something really bad happened." She's like, "Uh-oh, what?" And he's like, "I killed a neighbor girl." And she's like, "Oh no, look, this is the plan. We are going to put you in the walls of the house and you're going to live there for a few months until the heat blows over." Okay. And he's like, "Oh, great." And she's like, "We're going to use this part of the bathroom. We're going to wall it up. You're going to go into the little pantry cubby and you're just going to live in the walls." And he's like, "Okay, great." So cut to them putting all this shit together. And then he's like, "All right, bye, Mom." And then he's like, she's closing the door. She's like, "I'm going to give you the danger knock. If there's a danger knock, that means be really quiet." And he's like, "Okay." Meanwhile, I'm sitting there going, "Why can't Bad Ronald just live in the house until the cops come?"
Nope, you get in the walls
now. Mom wanted him in the freaking walls right away. Yeah. So he's just hanging out there. And like, you know, they would cut to them sitting side by side. You know, she'd have the pantry door, like the little cubby hole open, and they'd just be eating dinner. And she's like, "Okay, let me grab your plate." And he grabs a plate. And then she's like, "Don't forget your exercises." Closes the pantry, like cubby. So what happens is Mom dies. And then a new family moves in, and fucking
Ronald doesn't know. He's like, trapped in the walls.
Is it Bowsman?
No, it's I know, right? It's Dabney Coleman, right?
Oh,
well, Dabney Coleman
and his daughters.
And his daughters move in.
First rate.
Yeah, and Ronald, Bad Ronald, obviously starts fixating on these three girls, and then things get bad. And then it kind of ends anticlimactically, where you're just like, "Oh, Bad Ronald took a spill. He just fell," and then he's. And then something happens. But it's a made-for-TV movie. Scott Jacoby, Kim Hunter, Dabney Coleman, there's a bunch of people in it.
Yeah.
Really fascinating, weirdo little movie. But there is a fucking extreme version of that movie that could be made. I mean, movies have cherry-picked it, so I don't see a straight remake happening. But
I remember when they were doing the Black Christmas remake, Black Xmas, as it's now been famously known. What it sounded a lot the way they describe it is like it sounds like they're remaking Bad Ronald as the Black Christmas remake,
absolutely,
which would have been amazing. They kind of do it, but not really.
Yeah,
and then, there's another recent movie, but I don't want to say it's a major spoiler.
Yeah,
but if you've seen it, you know exactly what it is.
Yeah. Well, two movies from the same year.
Yeah, there's a comedy and
there's a straight horror movie. The straight horror movie straight up rips off the revelation of Ronald.
Yes, yeah.
And I was just like, "Oh, okay, someone did their homework."
Yeah. But I also will say that if you're looking like a comedic version, and I know Elric and I have talked about this before, the Australian Bad Boy Bubby feels very much kind of, if you were to go like comedy with this, it's got kind of
the same
pretty
tones. Dark too.
Yeah, it is. It's real dark and twisted.
But Bad Ronald is available on DVD only through Warner Archive.
It's wild. It's a wild one.
So that's my second
I can't even
Warner
imagine
title.
Like knowing it was a made-for-TV movie, like surfing through TV one night and happening upon Bad Ronald. It's just so weird.
So joyous.
Very
I love
unusual.
It.
Very unusual.
All right. Well, let's take a little break, and then we'll hear from our sponsors and come back with our topic. Out on Blu-ray now is The Devil's Reign from Severn Films, starring Ernest Borgnine, William Shatner, Ida Lupino, John Travolta, and High Priest of the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey. This release is loaded, a special edition loaded with tons of features, including interviews, commentary, trailers, and more. It's from a new 2K scan and comes in a limited slipcase available only at www.severn-films.com. Heaven help us all when the devil's reign comes.
Hail Satan!
It's face-melting good.
And also coming soon on December 5th is the Amicus Collection, which features the anthology Asylum, and Now the Screaming Starts, and The Beast Must Die, and the most terrifying movie ever made, Threads. So follow Severn Films on Facebook and look for that release on December 5th.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is movie buff owned and operated. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head on over to Diabolik DVD. They are constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. Lots of hard-to-find titles from Scorpion and Brulees from Code Red. Imports from all over the world, including titles from Camera Obscura, CMV, and more. They revamped their website earlier this year, and ordering has never been easier. And that's the only source you should order Code Red DVDs from. For safety, a guarantee.
This episode is also brought to you by Shudder, brought to you by AMC Networks. Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thriller, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals, and there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore.
New this week is Spookers, a close-knit New Zealand family-run Spookers, the largest and most successful haunted house in the Southern Hemisphere. The director deftly captures what's thrilling and enticing about haunted houses for the attendee, but more importantly, for the owners and employees, covering from all angles, from staff to the implications of using an abandoned asylum. Spookers is an encapsulation of why we love the genre and Halloween, as well as a touching look at those who feel freedom and family because of it. Streaming now exclusively on Shudder.
Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership, but our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere. Right, we are back, and before we dive into our topic, I just want to mention that Slashback Video is ending its run at the Mystic Museum. It was bound to end at some point, guys.
Which means we're getting our crap back.
Yeah,
nice.
I've really been missing my copy.
Wait a second,
of Blood
I
Salvage.
Sold all of that.
What?
How did it go? Like, I mean, I know the first nights went gangbusters, but overall, was that a success in the long run?
It maintained a steady crowd.
Nice.
It did really well. In fact, tonight I was getting texts from the team because we had a Scream Queen come through, and she's been Instagramming us, so that's really cool. But we're wrapping up on November 19th, Sunday. Before then, we are teaming up with Friday Night Frights in the Mystic Museum.
Yes.
For a screening of Blood Beach.
Hell okay. Yes.
Blood Beach.
The cops
is
are amazing.
Trapped on VHS. And I don't, based on the news, no, I shouldn't say news, but based on the conversations I've been having about it, I don't think Blood Beach will ever make its way to DVD or Blu-ray. So if you've never seen Blood Beach, come on down. We are having a screening at 8:30 p.m. on November 18th. Tickets are $6.66. And believe it or not, we're probably going to have some special guests from Blood
from
Beach.
Blood Beach.
I love it.
But it's
you got
on
the
VHS.
Monster.
We're screening it on VHS. They have a screen in the Mystic Museum that we're going to project it on. But it's mostly, I mean, listen, if you're coming for the fucking movie-going experience where you tell you to shut the fuck up, that's probably not going to happen because it's not exactly the theater environment. But this is kind of our last hurrah. It's going to be a reception. We'll have beer and food and whatnot. And you'll be able to walk around Slashback one more time, take some photos and whatnot, and then we're going to show the movie.
Any future Slashback fan?
There is, there are conversations being had right now. We have a lot of sponsors who are lining up to either take it on tour or get ready for Revenge of Slashback Video next year.
Oh, wow.
So we've got, there will be a future, but I want to make sure it's fresh each time.
Yeah.
I want to make sure it's fresh for the tour, and I want to make sure it's fresh for its return, hopefully next year. So
one of my favorite Slashback moments happened to Ryan and I a couple Fridays ago, but then on Twitter, where I was at, what do they call it now? Family Night in Burbank.
Oh,
ladies
yes,
night.
Yes.
It's where they bring out like all the food trucks and everything and line them up along Magnolia Boulevard in Burbank. And Marnie and I were out walking around, and I was like, I saw Ryan earlier across the street. So I was like, oh, I'll pop into Slashback and say hi to him. And I go in with Marnie, and we're hanging out and walking around and everything. And then a couple of days later on Twitter, we get this message, and he's like, coolest thing. It's like a live version of Shockwaves when you're standing in Slashback video and Ryan and Rebecca are having a conversation right next to you. And it was apparently one of the people who had come in to actually like look at the Slashback video was a fan
and didn't say anything. So listeners, if you see us in public, say hi.
Yeah.
But anyways, just want to drop that news for you guys. But moving on, topic time.
Yes.
Yes.
Basically, I think we do a lot of discussion about the classics of the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. But what about the aughts? What about 2000 on up? What are the future classics? I remember when I lived in New York City, AMC used to do a lot of advertising on the subway. Do you remember these, Rob? Where it was the future classics and it was films from like the late 80s on, and AMC had like, I forgot what the films that they were advertising, but I like that kind of term, future classics, because they were putting a stamp on movies that were obviously going to live on. So what are those horror films that are going to live on that came out from 2000 to say, what, 2009?
Well, I think to now. I mean, I think
to
part
now?
Of it.
Well, yeah.
I feel like it's a mixture. We could talk a little bit about our favorites if we have any that might not be classics. You might love them, but also, yeah. I mean, I'm curious because I think this year, last 2 years alone, I think there's been three or four movies. I'm not on my list, but ones that I just think are gonna be seen like that. With things like The Witch and Get Out, these are movies people are gonna be. They're gonna be pretty timeless.
Yeah. My interest in it is always like, how does it define a genre? Like most genres, time period, like decade.
The decade.
Most of the time, you can look at like the 1950s, and you say, name the top five horror films in the 1950s, and you can kind of rattle them off. For the 1960s, where you're like Night of the Living Dead, Rosemary's Baby, you know, you can kind of pick out 10 or less that define that decade. And I'm trying to figure out where that would be for the aughts, or since we're already at 2017, coming up on 2018, what would that be for the teens now? Like, what has defined us? I mean, I think haunted house films definitely.
And there's a lot more films.
What's going to be memorable?
A lot more films, a lot more places to watch films, which means it's just like how we grew up with TV. We all saw those TV shows because there was less of them. Mm. Now you don't all see those TV shows, and you wouldn't even – I don't even know what the hell Inside Number 9 is. Even though it's probably amazing, I don't know what it is.
You know, there was actually a thread on the fan page a couple of weeks ago about how the second episode may be the greatest thing cinematically ever made in the last 10 years. And you still haven't watched it.
But the point being, like, there's just a lot of indie films. So, like, whereas one of us watches Eyes of My Mother, right, and we'll go, that was great. Somebody else doesn't even see that movie, so therefore it probably won't become a future classic because it's probably fallen through, you know, even if it's a gem, it's different than a classic.
Well, you know, when you're in the period, you don't think of it that way, because I remember, like, obviously people look at the 90s as kind of like a dark time, but like, because there wasn't as much horror, but then something like Scream comes along, and then that kind of starts that whole wave. The 2000s are interesting to me for personal reasons. You know, I didn't. That's when I got into the horror web world. That's when I started writing about horror. You know, Icons of Fright, which is the first thing I did, was in 2004. And part of it was because we were right on that cusp of all these interesting new titles that I just wanted to talk about. Yeah. There were multiple things happening. Obviously, you know, 9/11 was a strange, scary time. And horror always reflects at times, but. Yeah, obviously, you know, for lack of a better word, torture porn kind of came out of that, the events of that, because that led us to, you know, kind of the Iraq thing and, you know, the idea in the news and media of torture. And that kind of bled into, even though I don't think like the original Saw is necessarily a torture porn movie, I think Hostel was the one that started that. It led us into this weird period where that's what was, at least at the box office, popular. But then at the same time, at least for me, because I remember this because I'm looking through the early days of my site, this is when the DVD market was kind of at its peak, and there were companies like Anchor Bay that Anchor Bay was making that transition in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. They were putting out all the Argento classics.
Yeah.
You know, Bill Lustig was there doing that stuff, the Fulci movies. But then slowly but surely, Anchor Bay is like, all right, we got an original for you. And it's Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. We got Hatchet. And all of a sudden, you're like, oh, this is so cool. Like, now there's these like little indie movies that may not get the theatrical, but where we could buy them on DVD. You know, they did Masters of Horror, the, you know, the Showtime series. So on a personal level, I was very much in tune with what was going on in the 2000s because that's when I was covering it the most. That was when I was really at my most excited about talking about these films.
Did anyone here see the new Saw yet?
No.
I haven't, did you?
No, and that's what I mean. This is kind of proof of the time, I think. For good or bad, it might be good. I don't know. And I want to see it at some point. But the fact that we didn't rush to see it shows me that maybe even the original Saw won't maintain as a classic status because it's of its time so much. Mm. And sometimes if you're too of your time, you don't actually transcend that. You know, I think things like Night of Living Dead and Texas Chainsaw are more than just a reflection of Vietnam and racism. Like they have something else that makes them feel classical. I don't feel that way about Hostel, and so I feel like they really are just responses
to the exact period. Yeah, I feel like the same way as Rob. It was like I came online as a horror fan in the 80s and 90s, then my taste started, growing in the 90s, but it was in the aughts that I became part of the industry and really started paying attention to movements and all that kind of stuff. But
and the rise of the indie. The rise of the American indie again.
There was
a lot more.
A lot of that. Yeah, absolutely.
And even the overseas stuff, because for a long stretch, I wasn't seeing overseas horror, but then it was like Tartan Asian Extreme really kicked it off. But then around that time, I started seeing things like Perfect Creature from New Zealand and a lot of Spanish horrors and then the French stuff come out. So there was like, it was an interesting time.
Yeah, various movements. Actually, multiple international movements.
But there was more. Right. Yeah. But in the midst of all of this content overload, what are the movies that are going to stand out? And to me, I feel like the movies that are going to stand out are the movies. I mean, like, you know, you make a good argument for Saw. Is Saw still a conversation piece? You know, it's these movies. It's the movies that when you go on the convention floor and go, oh, like 28 Days Later. 28 Days Later to me is going to live on forever. Yeah. Like that is one of the, you know, one of the big time classics.
Yeah, I've taken one from 99 because it was almost on the, so it won't be on my list. But Audition to me is like that, you know, and it's just on off the cusp. But I think Audition's a film that will, you know, as people, not everyone's necessarily seen it, but I think it's a classic, brilliant little Hitchcockian movie.
Yeah. I would say Battle Royale.
Yeah, that's right on the cusp too.
But yeah, that was definitely one that I think will stick.
But I mean, it's hard to do this objective. You have to be objective. You have to be subjective about this. I mean, you can't be subjective, rather, about it. Like, you have to go with what you actually love. I don't think we can sit back and go, well, what do you think's going to be classic? I mean, otherwise, it's everything's going to be The Witch and Get Out. Are there ones that you think deserve to be, but maybe haven't been seen, discovered yet?
Yeah, I structured my list like the ones that I think are going to be classic, which are the big theatrical hits, because those are the ones that people, you know, that enough people have seen that I think that it's going to be memorable for a widespread amount of people, like Paranormal Activity or Shaun of the Dead.
Well, there's the delineation between cult classics and then classics.
And like then I have some cult classics on here. And then I have ones that I was questioning, like Paranormal Activity was huge at the time, but does that have staying power?
Yes.
I think it does?
And I'm not just because I'm a Blumhouse employee, but I mean, like, you talk to people and they go, oh, I remember when I first saw that and I saw my friend Jeffrey and we jumped. I mean, like, it's one of those things. It's the movies that latch on to your inner being and stay with you, I feel like, you know?
I wonder, that one's tough to tell because of the way it's made. Like, I wonder 20 years from now, if they didn't know much about it and they just popped it in, whether it still have a power. Well, it's harder to tell.
The Blair Witch still has power, and it's structured similar manner.
Yeah.
So I think that it could potentially still have power. I think that, but there's definitely ones that were lesser known that I was like, dude, this totally deserves to be, like, Drag Me to Hell is one that I feel like it's getting a lot more love now than it was for a stretch, but I really feel like that deserves to be like a classic horror film.
Yeah. Yeah. I have Drag Me to Hell on that list, but I almost wonder if that's like the Halloween 3 of this list.
Yeah. I felt the same.
Where it's a bunch of, you know, everybody was like, the diehards were like, oh yeah, this is cool and different and fun. And the mainstream crowd was like, it's too goofy. But later on down the road, people will pick up on it and realize that that's a really fun movie. I had Final Destination, you know, Final Destination came out in 2000 in the wake of the Scream, you know, craze. And that's one that will live on, you know, 28 Days Later, The Ring, the Descent.
But that's my number one.
Yeah, I'd say Descent.
I mean, I remember just hearing about that because it took a while to come out here. It had come out over overseas, I think, But that was the one that I just kept hearing about from everybody. Like, oh, it's so freaking scary and this and that.
Right.
And then when it finally did come here, there was the whole controversy with the different ending and that whole deal. But yeah, that's the one that to me like stands out the most.
What are some, I mean, well, let's talk favorite. I mean, favorites as well from this period. Cause I mean, I think it's kind of similar. It doesn't mean they're going to break through. Like I have The Descent on my favorites list slash what I think is the best, but what are some other ones that maybe might, anything
Session
that might
nine.
Surprise me?
Session nine. Yeah, that's
Session
a good
nine.
One. I got to revisit that.
Lake Mungo was one for me that I wish people would discover enough to make it a classic, kind of like a reborn classic. Like, I feel like that movie deserves a lot more love than it gets. And thank you, BJ, for showing it to me like years ago. So.
I wonder, you know, it's funny because Ridley Scott's Hannibal came out in 2001. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's so... I remember when that movie came out, how grotesque it was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like I literally never, I mean, now in retrospect, especially because of the TV show, you watch it and it's like the last time I revisit it, it's almost goofy.
It is.
Because,
Disney,
you know,
Disney movie compared to the TV show.
I know, because Hopkins is pulling the whole like, okay then. Well, he's like doing this kind of goofy, quirky stuff as Hannibal Lecter. But at the time, I remember there was, I think I've told the story in the show before, I think it was about a week before it came out. It was maybe a press screening, and it's the only time I've ever seen Stephen King in person because he was sitting a few seats down with his son,
right,
watching the movie. And when it got to the ending, the dinner sequence, if you will, and one of the characters has the top of their head popped off, I mean, the whole audience was screaming and howling. They had never seen anything like that. A guy getting a piece of his brain kind of like fed to him. And I remember like 2 days later, like Stephen King posted something on Entertainment Weekly because he did a column for them at the time saying, yeah, even for me, it's in bad taste. And I thought that was hilarious because, you
That's
know,
right. I
him of
that,
all
actually,
people.
Yeah.
Well, here's a question I have for you guys. I mean, and I was thinking about this the other day. Do we, you know, collectively, does the mass audience just look at films differently than they did back in the day to deem certain films classics? I mean, like, are there, do you feel like everything is just so disposable that there are no contemporary classics that will be discussed further down the road?
I think that, that some will emerge.
And hyper-analyzed and
yeah,
and,
I mean,
you know.
I think I've been reading a lot of, I haven't rewatched others in a long time. I see it here. It's one I got to revisit. But
did
I always
forget it?
I kind of did.
Yeah.
But
a lot of people are writing about it, you know.
Right, right. But the fact that you forgot it makes me question, okay, did it have any sustainability?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
You know what's weird is also it's the release model. Because you had already mentioned Session 9. Mm. But like, is that a classic or is it a cult classic? That's not the sort of movie that got a wide release.
Right.
And the thing is, it's very hard for movies these days that we discuss. Like, you know, Texas Chainsaw, hypothetically, would Texas Chainsaw Massacre, an indie movie, Halloween, an independent movie, you know, those are movies that played, you know, town to town and grew.
And grew, yeah.
You know, would, if they came out today, would they get a mass? I mean, it's kind of funny to me that Texas Chainsaw, the remake in 2003, got this ginormous release and was this big deal, whereas the first one was not that at all.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that factors into it too, because will people just look at The Conjuring and Insidious and like the movies that got the wide releases?
Absolutely.
As the
I would think so. But I do think that you will see a certain growth under some of the cult ones. I mean, like the smaller ones, that's what we had with Trick or Treat, where when Trick or Treat was first released, everybody was like, what the hell is this? And it took a couple of years of it being out and streaming various places for people to suddenly be like, Sam is our new god. And now I would definitely put that into the classics realm, not even cult classic. I would be inclined to call it like a classic of the horror genre from this time period. Now,
I have a sneaking suspicion that Trick or Treat, like Nightmare Before Christmas, in about probably a couple years more time, we're going to see Sam all over everything.
Yeah, I think
Nightmare,
so too.
It was funny. The kid had Nightmare Before Christmas on during the holiday break. And I was like, I remember I was the only one in Wallingford, Connecticut who saw it opening night. There was no one. No one. And then I went to school. Anybody go see Nightmare Before Christmas? Crickets.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's like Jack Skellington is on license plates and on the back of somebody's car.
He's
I think if they make
everywhere.
A Trick or Treat sequel, that's what will happen. It'll just bring it back into a consciousness.
Maybe, yeah.
So the five that I wrote down, I'm just going to say them because then we'll realize they're kind of cult, which is The Descent for sure. Mm. I think the best film of that decade personally is Let the Right One In. Mm-hmm. I think that holds up as an absolutely perfect movie, basically. And then some weird Kill List, I think, is the one that got me the most of all the films I saw. I saw it at AFI at midnight, so it hadn't had any kind of pre-screening, and it actually kind of scared me, which is rare to do, and I just was unnerved by it. But again, total cult. It's not, you know, not well known. And House of the Devil, you know, between Descent and House of the Devil, I've told you guys a million times, they're the two that got me back into horror in a way where I just like post-Scream and stuff kind of floating away. And then these two movies, seeing them at the same time, was like, yes, please, more of that. I think it stands for all the good things about an indie vision, you know, even though it's set in the 80s. And then I'm throwing Martyrs on a list for me. It's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but it packs a punch. And if you only watch one film, I think from the French extreme, that would be the one, because it's really trying to actually say something. It's pretty powerful and unforgettably gross.
So I came up with a question, more of like a philosophical question. For a film to become classic, does it have to be timeless, or can it reference other decades, like be self-referential or like making fun of something? And Scream,
I think it's hard to make,
Well, Scream ended up becoming a classic, and that's definitely like referencing the slasher era.
If you want to put Scary Movie on your list, it's okay.
No, you guys know how much I love the Scary Movie franchise.
Yeah, but Scream is a genuine horror movie, too.
It is.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So I put American Psycho on because I was like, it's a legit horror film, even though that it's about the 80s and it's referencing that. I think it's a legit horror film. But would Cabin in the Woods, does that have sustaining power, or do you have to exist in the world where all of those things, you know, where it made sense, like in 25 years or even 50 years?
Absolutely, because those tropes and those stereotypes that Cabin in the Woods is referencing will stand the test of time. I mean, the movie is making fun of films from the 80s, and it came out in 2014?
You know, the way that we look at Nosferatu or, you know, Cabinet of Caligari right now, in 100 years when people are watching Cabin in the Woods, is it going to have the same kind of staying power, because people aren't going to be like, oh, it's making fun of films from the 80s.
But also they're horror films, and Cabin in the Woods is horror-ish, but it's also comedy. Mm-hmm. Like, that's, people are going to go back and enjoy it as a comedy, self-referential on horror films, like classic in that sense, I think are more timeless, because they're just what they are. They're just cinema. You're not watching it for the joke or the reference. I do think those things are more classical, but again, you're splitting hairs at that point, probably.
Yeah.
Cabin in the Woods to me is going to be like, it's like a Halloween style favorite. That's like the party movie. Yeah. If you want something just fun in the background, that could fit and hit that, you know, horror mark, but at the same time, just be kind of funny and just, you know, That's what I always, and I love that movie. So, for me, I agree with you. Let the Right One In is probably going to be the top one of that entire decade. The Descent, obviously, but other than that, Cloverfield. And a lot of people forget about it, but there's not many found footage movies that I actually like. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's one of the most brilliant uses of it, because it literally adheres, you know, post Cloverfield, people broke the rules a little bit about it being a storytelling device. But that's the only one I could think of that really adheres to all the rules perfectly. Anytime they need backstory, it's like the tape kind of, you know, ends and you get to see what's underneath it that's being erased. Like, it's like, it's brilliantly executed. And also, like, what a teaser. Like, that was a big deal when there was no name on it. It was just this teaser that basically recreated the Escape from New York poster, which is exactly what inspired it. And I got to tell you, I saw it in New York City at a preview, and it felt, you know, because this is still only a few years after 9/11, and coming out of the theater after watching New York City get destroyed into New York City, and it's still kind of being there as is, was a really surreal feeling. And so that movie stuck with me a little bit more because of that, because of where I saw it and how it made me feel. But I still think that's a pretty brilliant.
I agree with
of
you.
The found footage movies.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree with you. I like it's a grounded Godzilla movie. It's Godzilla through like the lens of a camera being, you know, held by someone running around and trying to survive. What stuck with me too, I mean, and this is really sappy to say, but it's the love story element. You know, this is about a guy who is just trying to get to uptown Manhattan to save his girlfriend.
Wow.
And he attains that goal, but there are giant stakes involved. But I love the Cloverfield's use of slowly peeling away plot-wise at details about this creature that's rampaging through New York. It can do this, it could do that. It's a little clumsy. It doesn't really have any objective. It's got things crawling around on it. And if you get infected by it, then you blow up. It's there was just like so many cool things that it was just more than a monster running rampant through New York. There was just other things going on underneath it.
Do you think we have anything like Chainsaw, Nightmare, Night of the Living Dead, and Exorcist? So when we
you're talking about
something that in 20 years people would look back and go, oh yeah, you got to watch these three movies from that period because they're so fucking good. And because those are kind of like, I don't think there's anyone, unless they hate horror, who one of those wouldn't totally work for. One of those three would be the movie that would scare them. They'd think it's the best horror film ever made of those three films.
I think The Conjuring is going to be this generation's Exorcist. Because you have to remember, The Exorcist was a big studio movie. Unlike the other examples you gave, like Chainsaw, Halloween, those are things, they're independent, but that was a big studio. I mean, I just finished listening to Inside the Exorcist, amount of money that they spent to make that movie and make it happen is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
So to me, like that's the one that comes to mind of in terms of modern
horror. It is hard when you're in it,
I'll mention Get Out.
That absolutely will. That absolutely will stand the test of time.
Because Get Out, the thing that Jordan did so well is just delivered something different. Conjuring is more or less a haunted house movie.
Sure.
And it's done very well. It's executed very well, and there's a lot of scares. What Jordan's movie did is provide commentary and also provide something that's entertaining and provide something that's scary. So
yeah, suspenseful more than scary. I think that's where it really succeeds. Suspense, which is harder to do now. I think
Black Swan has a bit more staying power than I think.
Could be. I got to rewatch that. Actually, you're right.
A lot of the people that I talk to who I wouldn't suspect are diehard horror fans know Black Swan and enjoyed it and really liked the scares in it. And even though that it isn't a horror film throughout the whole thing, it definitely, you know, it's considered to be a horror film by everybody.
I think on a pure kind of, if we're talking about horror movie diet of something that is good for you, even though it's a little hollow story-wise, narratively, is The Strangers. Strangers is pure execution. Yeah. There's not much going on a narrative motor. There's nothing that's all much there to chew on, but it certainly is just a kind of a fun, tasty movie to really just throw on and become immersed by.
And It Follows will be in that kind of similar model. It'd be a lot of style. That's going to definitely have legs. Yeah.
It Follows, I think It Follows has a lot more to say. Strangers is you know.
It's more abstract, though. It Follows is what it's saying is abstract.
Yeah, I think The Strangers has, the one hook that a lot of these movies have is they have one striking visual where you immediately recognize what it is. Mm-hmm. And the thing, you know, I don't know if It Follows has that, whereas The Strangers, you see them, it's funny. I've only seen the movie like once when it first came out and I loved it, but it really upset me. And that's why I haven't gone back to it.
Right.
I'm really curious about how the sequel
holds
will
up.
Play.
Holds up,
but that's the thing is anytime I see the imagery, I still remember the way the movie made me feel.
And this is the weird thing. I shattered a tooth while watching The Strangers. I kid you not. It was in New York. I was at the press screening of The Strangers.
Oh, Becca.
Popcorn kernel on a back molar shattered my tooth. I had to leave the screening. But whenever I see those characters, I remember the pain. It reminds me of it so much. So I can never watch that movie again. But I agree. It does have some staying power. Even if your teeth don't hurt when you look at it.
I'll throw a questionable one out there in terms of if you want to call it horror, and I think it's absolutely a horror movie, but one of my favorites of the entire decade is David Fincher's Zodiac. Sure, it's still my favorite David Fincher movie.
I think it's one of the best films that decade, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I wasn't living here yet, but I was in town, and I remember a whole bunch of us went to go see it at the Arclight, and just being, I mean, I knew a bit about the Zodiac Killer, but I think it's just Fincher's style and all the actors telling that story in the way that it was told. I think it's one of his most well-crafted films that it'll be one of those that if it pops up on TV or you happen to catch it, you can't help but not watch it.
Mm-hmm. And there are some genuine horror, like the sequence where the person's downstairs and you.
Oh, I thought that was
somebody's
scary.
Upstairs. Well, you actually are scared.
The first, you know, with the couple making out and him coming out, that is, it's so stark and it takes place in the daytime.
The
and
song
just, like,
that plays,
you
the hurdy-gurdy man.
You hear the stabbing. You're just like, it's just, that really upset me more than most things I see in horror movies.
Because that guy's real.
He's, yeah, exactly.
He's a real guy out there doing that. It's pretty crazy. crazy.
One that I wish would get classic status, kind of going back to the one that you really wish would, you know, blow up a bit more or become cult, is Autopsy of Jane Doe.
I think that's just a matter of time.
I really feel like that one is destined for greatness.
I agree with you. I totally forgot about it. That would be in my top five for, like, of ones I really think will catch on as like a yearly viewing for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it was the perfect roller coaster.
Yeah, it was such a tight little film.
Right. I think we all watched it and were kind of shocked when it wasn't being more talked about by the end of that year. Yeah. That was surprising.
Yeah, that was one that like I expected it to blow up, like an It Follows style blow up, where like a couple of people saw it at a couple of festivals and then a giant company acquires it and it goes like widespread, or like The Witch did, or The Babadook.
Maybe it needs to be in
the
theater.
Didn't do it.
Like, we got to experience that in an amazing theater and then everyone else is watching at home alone. Maybe it doesn't work in the cinema.
Well, I saw it that way, but you know, sometimes it's timing, because The Autopsy of Jane Doe, I remember, came out like last December. Mm-hmm. Like literally
they released
the
it like right before Christmas.
During the Christmas holiday, where it's like, it's kind of, I don't know, that's kind of a weird spot to release a horror movie.
If you haven't seen it, please go check it out. It's one of those that I really think that it was, you know, I don't know why it didn't do like a witch-sized release.
Yeah, that's one of those future discovery episodes.
And I think Wreck is a really fantastic.
Boom, top of my list. That was my number one.
That one, when I saw that the first time, it really had power.
Yeah.
Like, it really knocked my socks off. Yeah, they're both good, but Wreck, because Wreck didn't come with anything.
Yeah,
you know?
Wreck came out of
nowhere.
It goes
in wild places.
It does, but it puts you front and center in the action.
I know, but it's more action than horror. I don't know. The first one is actually scary because, like, you don't know what they've got. You don't know what's wrong.
And I hadn't seen movies like that at that time, because we weren't at the height of found footage. And I remember being sent to the press screening, and I had like just started at Fangoria at that point. And, you know, seeing these things running at you and everything, it blew my freaking mind. Like, that was one that I actually like was like, okay, I'm a bit shaken from that. Mm. So.
I think there's a lot of good horror post-2000. I've got to say, like, besides some of the obvious tropes that we're going on, there's a lot of stuff. I don't know if it's all classic. A lot of it is indies that you mine for gems and go, wow, there's all these great little movies.
Prom Night 2008 is fantastic.
Oh, get out of here, you. Hush you.
There's so many bad ones. Okay, well, there's a lot of those, that cycle. But you mean Antichrist is one. Like, there's a lot that I personally like. I like with this intersection of art house and horror that really exploded around.
Here's the thing. I think... You know, and you know, I'm not knocking us for tackling the subject, but I don't know if we're all ready to really reflect. I mean, we've we grew up in a generation where we saw the release of Day of the Dead, but we probably didn't see it until much, much later in life when it had aged, and we're like, what the hell is everybody talking about? This is a great Romero zombie movie. I just feel like...
Well, The Thing, right? Like, imagine if we'd been out going, it's okay. It's not as good. E.T., let's go see E.T., guys. Yeah. It's like, now we're like, holy shit.
Oh, my God. Guys, we should totally do an episode like it's 1981 or 82 or something.
Oh,
The Thing's so boring.
That would be fun. Virtual reviews.
Becca, what'd you do? Well, I went to the burger joint and roller skates.
I teased up my hair, put some neon eyeshadow on, and, like, went to see The Fox.
Well, Ryan's a big fan. You go into old Fangoria, like, letters to show trolls.
I love your trolling.
You're like, look at this troll from 85 that wrote to Fangoria magazine about how they hate this.
Yeah, so many pretentious motherfuckers like, Carol Ann's not a very cool character in a Poltergeist, man. Well, she just got caught.
It's true, guys.
How dare she get caught up in a closet? I would have crawled myself.
You know what? We should read
trolls.
That'd be a great thing for our show. We should
just keep digging them out.
Trolls are not an invention of the internet. These existed long before. You just have to read the letters.
Well, there was that one. What was the one that I posted on Instagram where it was like, Drew Barrymore really sucked as Carol Ann? I was like, that wasn't Drew Barrymore, dude. Phil in Oklahoma.
Right. No, it's interesting when you get the context. I have to mention our friend Axel Carolyn wrote a book called It Lives Again, Horror Movies in the New Millennium.
Yeah.
And I remember in that time period, because this came out a couple of years ago, but thinking like right at the tail end of the 2008, 2009, thinking like, oh my God, like what's the last 8 years been? And then I kind of combed through it. And yes, there are gems, because then you see things like, you know, Fezzedin's Wendigo.
Inside, you know.
Some of the French stuff.
Or Pulse. Cairo, whatever. Yeah. The Korean version. The Japanese version, not the remake.
I just feel like, we talk about these classics. I feel like the ones that are classics to me are just the ones I reach to time and time again. I mean, the ones that are part of my collection, not just for analysis, but the ones I actually watch over and over. Like 28 Days Later, The Strangers, Hills Have Eyes remake, Ginger Snaps. These are the movies that stand the test of time.
And May.
Then I see new
May.
Things.
May. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great film.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you guys think? It. Is it going to be here? I mean, and granted, yes. This has just come out, so we're like hot off of it. Is it going to be here in 50 years?
I think it'll depend on the sequel. I think the sequel will be a continuing story. So if it's as good as that, then yeah, it's going to be. I mean, the first one is a good movie, but I think a lot of that will depend, because if you end a story poorly, it really does reflect.
Well, I mean, but look at the 1991, which yeah. still, whether you've seen it or not, people know Pennywise.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It has become a cultural phenomenon from 1990. I think the modern interpretation is totally a cultural phenomenon, and I think it's going to last no matter what. You know, yeah. It's just that's a
oh,
it's,
the that's, icon will for sure.
Yeah, that's the one the that thing about King. Yeah. You know, for whatever reason, that's the one story that I think is universal and will yeah. sure stand out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about like let's do? Obviously, we're talking about stuff that we think is gonna be classic. But what are some of the gems from the 2000s that are kind of our cult favorites that we wish more people would discover? I got so many.
I didn't write
yeah,
any
I mean,
down.
That's my favorite
so
stuff.
Well, May is definitely in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why I said Killist is absolutely sure. the one I want people to find if they haven't found.
Well, obviously for me, Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie yeah. Vernon is. I mean, I just remember getting so giddy excited within the first 15 minutes of watching it, and the way that they comment on kind of the breakdown of the slasher movie. Somewhat in the same way that Scream did it, but this one did it even more, like the whole idea of the red herring, and then like, you know, Robert Englund shows up and becomes the Ahab, and you're like, oh my god, that's supposed to be Loomis. Like, I get all these rules, and I just remember being just so blown away by how that broke down the horror movie in such a unique way, but then became a cool horror movie in the third act. Mm-hmm. So that one to me stands out. I love horror comedy, and obviously, I think Shaun of the Dead is going to be the classic, but the one that everyone forgets about, maybe because of the sequels, is the original Feast, the first Feast, the Project
oh,
Greenlight.
Yeah.
I fucking love Feast so much. And I'll tell you, I did not watch Project Greenlight. I didn't know about it that way.
The way I
knew about it was I was at a Fangoria Weekend of Horrors in New York City, and I believe Clue, you know, John Gulager and Clue were there, and Diane, and I think Judah Friedlander, I just met him at the time. And they showed the opening sequence from Feast. And I mean, that crowd ate it up. And, you know, I love Evil Dead too. So I'm like, holy shit, this is like Evil Dead style right. lunacy where all the characters' names are coming up. And it was like giving stats about them yeah. and their like odds for living and stuff. And so that one is just pure fun. It's like lean and short, you know, and to the point. And, you know, two or three, I think you like. Three a lot. I remember hearing you talk about the Feast sequels a lot.
That was another Ryan.
That was Ryan Rotten.
That was Ryan Rotten.
Whole other guy. But that's one I wish people would go back and check out, because that first one is really, really fun.
You know what? I just remembered Devil's Rejects.
Oh yeah.
Devil's
oh,
Rejects.
You're right. That's a glad
gets
agree.
Better and better. And yeah, really I was on the fence when I first saw it. I was like, oh well, it's not like House of a Thousand Corpses. What the hell is this? And then I digested it, gave it another year, waited for the DVD to come out, liked it kind of, and then I put it away for 5 years. When I got back, I was like, oh, this is there's some revelations going on right now.
Yeah,
it's a really cool movie. There's some really cool stuff going on, and it's also probably Rob's best thing
by far. Know? Yeah, really, I think that's it's just
it's where it all comes together for him.
Yeah, it's a movie
really
everything
assured hand directing that movie. He knew exactly what the tone needed to be. He knew exactly what the visual style needed to be, and the music, everything.
And he wasn't just his influences. He's largely his influences, but he wasn't just. I think when he plays into the parody or the jokes, he's not as good.
Yeah.
Like when he goes full TCM too much, it doesn't work. But that movie really balances.
Yeah.
It's a good movie.
Yeah.
I was just reminded of, and you guys are going to give me shit for this, but there were some of the early 2000s creature features.
Oh.
No, like Pitch Black. I loved that movie when it came out.
Pitch Black is dope.
Yeah, it's 2000. It's 2000. Yeah, it's 2000. I fucking loved that film
Pitch Black
when it came
is
out.
Good sci-fi horror.
Well, I think the sequels and what came after, because then they did like the really
the Chronicles
they got
of Riddick.
The Chronicles, and they were like fighting the Necro something.
You kind of forget that Pitch Black was like a cool like Aliens riff.
Yes.
Like, that's what I remember about it.
And even like the most recent one, when they went back to the Aliens thing, it wasn't that bad. It was a little bit bit too much Vin Diesel saying things like, I'm going to go balls deep and dull or something like that, which is an actual line from the movie.
Yeah, they went off the rails on that whole series. Yeah, but if you go
Pitch
back.
Pitch Black was awesome. Wow.
Pitch Black is awesome.
And I really enjoyed The Cave as well when it first came out. The Cavern was like a shit knockoff. That one I was kind of like not there for. But The Cave, was like,
The Descent
cool
wipes the floor
guy.
With The Cave.
Oh, no, The Descent wipes the floor. But
but
on
also
the
a
Descent.
Patrick Tatopoulos designed monster.
Yeah.
The Cave and Pitch Black.
Yeah, I like both of them. But on The Descent, I remember really liking Creep. And Creep got a lot of crap it came out.
Oh, I like that one.
Chris Smith.
And I remember Chris Smith. And Chris Smith
Triangle.
Had like two back-to-back because he had Triangle like right after that fucking awesome
But they're definitely
awesome little film.
Cult films.
Those
not,
are cool.
Yeah.
No.
Queen of the Damned.
Severance.
Yeah.
Queen of the Damned, guys.
Severance
We need to
awesome.
Talk about Queen.
Yeah. Kiss of the Damned.
No.
Queen of the
Damned.
Aaliyah.
I'm talking about
Aaliyah,
guys.
But in terms of classic, I actually do think there's one other actual classic, and I think it's, it's When You're Up a Bit. It's, I think, The Mist in Black and White.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's actually plays as a classic movie. Like, when I saw it in color, I liked it and stuff. When somebody showed it to me in black and white, I was like, wow, this would, go the test of time. It's pretty amazing watching it like that. Because it really feels like a Twilight Zone.
Another
episode.
One that I've always been really passionate about that not a lot of people love that I think Ryan enjoys it as well is The Ruins.
I like The Ruins.
Yeah. I've always loved that film.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a classic, too.
I don't think it's going to be a classic. I'm saying it deserves more
no,
love.
No, it's okay. It's fun. Yeah,
You know which one I want to revisit is 30 Days of Night. Because I don't remember that, but I don't remember liking it a lot.
Like, I remember liking it a lot.
Really? Because I love the comic book, and I remember being disappointed with the movie interpretation.
That's
of
such
it.
A great idea behind
it. Yeah, the concept is great.
Yeah, it's not if it was pulled off like The Descent, it would be amazing because it has a lot of similar kind of.
The problem is it's narrative fuel. It runs out of steam about halfway through.
I just remember a lot of running around. Like, I can't even tell you plot points or what the characters were. I just remember the setup of that's death coming, and then a whole bunch of shit. Shows up and people run, and that was like.
Though David Slade's movie before, I think, is a classic, Hard Candy.
Oh,
I think that's like a perfect little film. So,
And what about on the Spanish front, like things like Pan's Labyrinth and The Orphanage, like.
I would research Orphanage. Yeah. I haven't seen that for a long time. Pan's Labyrinth is a classic, but I don't know if it's a horror classic. It feels more like a fantasy.
It's a fantasy. The Orphanage is The Orphanage for sure. Devil's Backbone.
Yeah, I think it's from this period. Yeah, I don't think I would call it a classic. I'll call it a cool discovery.
And then there's The Orphan. I thought that had a pretty creepy shit in that, man.
I liked Orphan.
I thought it was kind of scary when that just happened.
I would be so bold as to add House of Wax to the slasher classic.
It is
so much fun. You will not have any complaints from me on that one. I, too, like House of Wax.
I think House of Wax is like House on Haunted Hill 13 Ghosts fun. I don't know if it's like the greatest
House of Wax on a pure like filmmaking level is way above
13 Ghosts. Yeah, I'll agree with that.
Oh yeah,
like, there was actually really cool stuff in that. Yeah.
I'd put it like top 10 Paris Hilton. Like, Paris Hilton bar top 10. Boom, mic drop.
You're a wild man.
But there's a lot of good movies. I think that if we've proven anything, that's probably it. We haven't probably proven anything can be. I mean, because High Tension's almost classic. I don't know.
Yeah,
people walking away from this episode are like, what do they get? What did they give?
I don't know.
They just threw a lot of titles out there.
We need an adjudicator to.
Well, Ryan touched on this. Let's just to I don't know if we want to wrap on this, but let's talk. Remakes, because remakes became a big thing, and you mentioned The Hills Have Eyes, which I do think is a pretty strong one.
Yep.
Do you think things like Dawn of the Dead and what's the other big one, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for example, will these remakes stand the test of time as well?
I watched Dawn of the Dead, the remake, when it came out on DVD a lot because I was just really into it. I just thought it was a really, really great interpretation. I love the style, I love the look, I love its kinetic pacing, I love the zombie. It was just. And then I kind of put it on a back burner for a while. Went back and revisited it, and I think I just got burned out on it.
Yeah.
So I'm a little burned out on it, but I still stand by it.
I think the opening is exceptional.
Yeah. And also the ending. I mean, it's pretty solid ending too with the island stuff. But
I don't know. the answer to this, but I'm intrigued if younger generations resonated more with like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the remake, than they did with the original. And is that the one that's going to be kind of sacred to them? Like,
oh boy.
I don't think that's going to be sacred to anyone. That remake. I don't think those movies have that kind of power. The new Friday 13th, they're not terrible. I just don't think they have
Chainsaw
remake.
Then, like,
yeah, Texas Chainsaw remake.
I think
Friday
that holds. I think that holds with the
You think
with
somebody's sitting around watching that thinking, yes. I think they're more likely to think that about Devil's Rejects.
I think there's a kid sitting there listening to Slipknot and watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
And I mean, like, I have to say, like, I remember, and I'm hoping this is true, John Humphrey, I remember, enjoyed one of those remakes. Like, I remember having this conversation with him. And he
was
definitely
they're all about it.
A good, like, 15 years younger than
I feel
me,
like
so.
They, but they tend to like the original. I think the original stuff always holds true. I feel like Devil's Rejects more likely to be their Texas Chainsaw than that is, if you know what I mean.
For sure.
Yeah.
In my opinion. And
okay.
I think that's a good thing. Like, I'd rather Rob Zombie be your god than a remake be your god. Because like, at least he's trying to do his own thing.
Now, let me throw one out that's, I don't want to say it's controversial, and I'm not trying to shit on it, so don't, let's
oh, boy. Amityville Horror.
No.
The Fog remake?
Is Cabin Fever a classic?
Oh, Eli Roth.
And because here's the thing. I like the movie. I actually like Eli's first. I like that. I like Hostel. Mm-hmm. But, like, I don't get the Cabin Fever, like the hype around it. You know what I mean? Like, it was talked about as if it was one of the, like, best horror movies of the early 2000s. I don't know if it's the Peter Jackson quote or whatever. I saw it, and I'm like, yeah, it's pretty good. Mm. But I never thought it was, like, one of the best.
It's a cult classic.
Frat
but
boy
it
horror.
Did, yeah, but it did elevate him into that status.
I think that it had the right mix of sex and gore right at that time when not a lot of people were doing that.
Yeah,
we seeing a lot
that.
Of
I think
art
we needed
dread.
That movie. Yeah.
I mean, we hadn't reached the torture porn yet. We were seeing a lot of these, like, quiet ghost films like The Others and things like that. And so I think that seeing, like, this mix of, like, boobs and blood was, you know, it spoke to a lot of people. Yeah. So yeah, it's going to have some staying power. Yeah. I can't speak to the sequels, but and the remake, it's already been remade. So yeah.
So can you believe that?
I think we've come to our conclusion. Yes is the answer.
Yes. Yes.
Well,
yes.
Take listeners, take to Facebook and Twitter, and you tell us what you're what
are
you
the,
think of
what the, are going to be classics, stone cold classics.
Does anyone else like The Cave?
Don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes, star rating on iTunes, and like us on Facebook and Instagram and the Twitters.
And if you're interested in advertising, please email me at shockwaves@blumhouse.com. Again, that's shockwaves@blumhouse.com if you're interested in advertising.
Boom. Later.